From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, exhuming mass graves in Bosnia, we talk with Dr. William Haglund, who is leading a team of forensic anthropologists investigating the graves for the International War Crimes Tribunal. Also, the author of The Godfather has returned to the genre that made him famous. Mario Puzo has a new novel called The Last Don. We'll talk with him about writing the Godfather novel and screenplays. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. There has been a military coup in Burundi. The former Tutsi president, who had governed the Central African nation until 1993, has resumed power. The BBC's Jane Stanley reports from Bujumbura.
Pierre Buyoya addressed Burundians on national radio to tell them that he was once again the president. He's taken power in Burundi in a coup before, in 1987, but he allowed democratic elections to take place 5 years later. Pierre Buyoya announced that Burundi's airports and borders were closed and that all political parties were immediately suspended. He's also suspended parliament. So far, Bujumbura has remained calm, but it's highly uncertain what the next few days will bring. The radio broadcast said all Hutu politicians who had gone into hiding were safe to emerge, including the now-deposed president, Sylvester Ntibantunganya, who sought sanctuary at the American ambassador's house. Jane Stanley, BBC News, Bujumbura.
Algerian state television reports authorities overpowered a hijacker aboard a plane in the western city of Oran. 232 people were freed. He took over the Algerian plane just before takeoff. The North African nation has been plagued by violence over the last 4 years. The government is battling militant Islamic groups. The National Transportation Safety Board reports the two flight recorders aboard TWA Flight 800 are battered but usable. The boxes were shown to the media this morning. Today, investigators hope to learn from the recorders what caused the crash. NPR Steve Inskeep reports.
Navy divers brought up two orange boxes, each banged up but in relatively good shape, each marked with an inscription, flight recorder, do not open. Robert Benson of the National Transportation Safety Board says when they are opened, one box will show the last instrument readings before the blast, the other may carry the flight crew's last words.
This is a giant step ahead. I'll caveat that by saying that sometimes these recorders don't produce the data everybody expects them to because of the suddenness of the final event.
Any clues in the recordings will have to be matched against the wreckage of the plane, most of which is still strewn across 2 miles of ocean floor. I'm Steve Inskeep on Long Island, New York.
President Clinton is meeting with the families of the victims of TWA Flight 800. He's been joined by First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton and the French and Italian ambassadors to the United States. Family members of the victims have bitterly complained about what they feel is the slow pace of recovery efforts. Half of the bodies of victims remain to be found. The families are also upset with the lack of information or the confusing stories they're hearing. New York Governor George Pataki says the National Transportation Safety Board will now coordinate informational briefings and the families will be told first. On Wall Street, the Dow is up nearly 60 points at 5,414. This is NPR. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and House Speaker Newt Gingrich say they're confident President Clinton will sign welfare reform legislation when it reaches his desk, possibly by next week. They say they'll accept no changes that would weaken the bill. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The president is hoping a House-Senate conference committee will add vouchers or some other means of protecting poor children when their families run out of benefits. But Lott and Gingrich say the vouchers issue failed in both bodies and is not likely to come back in conference. In a letter to the president, they say Republicans have met the administration more than halfway. Gingrich doubts the president can afford another, quote, broken campaign promise.
I believe the president has an absolute moral obligation to sign this bill. He campaigned in 1992, promising to end welfare as we know it. He's running commercials after having vetoed welfare reform twice. He is running commercials saying he's in favor of welfare reform we're about to send him welfare reform.
White House spokesman Mike McCurry says the president is hoping for a better bill, but is working toward a signature, not a veto. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
IBM has reported better-than-expected profits. The computer maker actually reported a 22% profit decline due to slowing sales, lower prices, and a strong dollar. But while computer sales were off slightly, services and consulting grew strongly. IBM earned more than $1.33 billion, or $2.51 per share. The formerly all-male Citadel Military School of South Carolina has accepted four women as cadets for the coming school year. Only one has announced her intention of attending. Two other women say they'll attend school elsewhere, and a fourth hasn't made a final decision yet. Kim Messer says she'll be there when school opens, whether other women attend the Citadel or not. Her enrollment comes after the Supreme Court last month declared the male-only admissions policy at Virginia Military Institute unconstitutional. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. William Haglund, is engaged in the grim work of exhuming mass graves in Bosnia. He's a forensic anthropologist from Seattle who's leading a forensic team organized by the group Physicians for Human Rights. After the bodies are exhumed, they're being examined by a team of pathologists. These teams are mandated to provide evidence of war crimes to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. The information the teams uncover will also be made available to Bosnians who are looking for loved ones who disappeared during the war. Thousands of Muslim men disappeared as cities fell to the Serbs during the war, and many of these Muslims are believed to now lie in mass graves. Haglund has exhumed mass graves in Rwanda and Central America. He's former chief medical investigator for King County, Washington. Earlier this summer, he exhumed a mass grave in Cherska. Now he's working on a series of smaller graves in Nova Kasaba, just outside of Srebrenica. 154 bodies in the Cherska grave were buried with their hands tied behind their backs. We phoned Haglund yesterday, and he told us he's also finding bodies with their hands bound in the new graves.
The scenario at the pastures we're presently digging at Nova Kasaba, the first seven individuals, all of them had their hands bound behind their backs, some with wire, and that the grave that we've just taken out eight, and there are more yet to come out, the majority of those also have had their hands bound behind their back.
I guess that's pretty surefire evidence of execution.
Well, it's certainly surefire evidence that they weren't combating when they died.
What you're doing this work for the International Criminal Tribunal. What information are they hoping to learn from the mass graves that you're investigating?
Well, from the investigations themselves of the graves, you, number one, wish to confirm indeed that there are graves there, that there are bodies present. Number two, whatever the scenario of witnesses or investigative information, you wish to try to see if the information in the grave collaborates that information. So from the graves, you hope to collect evidence. You hope in the collection of evidence that you might be able to identify some individuals so that they can be returned to their families. You would also would be creating a historical document as you collect the evidence, which would stand up to historical revisionists who say, oh, gee, nothing happened there. There's no people dead. There's no people in the grave. They're just combatants. They died of cholera or whatever people are wont to say. You would hope that the information, that the evidence collected can be given over, in this case, to the tribunal, and that individuals responsible can be held accountable. And then I think the highest hope, the supreme hope of all this might be too optimistic, but you would hope that these kinds of endeavors in the future can help that these incidents would not happen again in the future, would not be repeated, that people would be prone to kill people, to take advantage of them like this, would think, well, the world is watching, and I'm going to be held accountable. I can't do this.
What phase are you in with the grave that you're exhuming now?
Well, we're going in sequence from one grave to another. We're going to have a presence in this area for 2 to 3 months, just in the exhumation phase. We've finished one grave. We're at the second location that looks like it's several smaller graves. Then we'll proceed to another. Now, after we've finished the first exhumation, those bodies have been removed to another site where we'll be collecting all the bodies we exhume, and they will be examined in a morgue environment.
Could you give us a picture of what you've learned so far about looking at the big picture, all the graves that you've exhumed so far? What have you learned about who was killed, and what clues do you have about who did the killing?
Well, we've just completed one grave. We know that individuals in civilian clothing were killed, that probably most of them are going to be males, that many of them died defenseless with their hands bound behind their back. At the particular site we looked at, we know where the killers basically stood. We knew where victims were when they were killed. We knew where found out where the dirt that covered them up was taken from. That kind of information.
Where you are now in Nova Kasaba, would you have realized that that area had graves? Could you see that with the naked eye? Is it noticeable?
If we were driving along the road and didn't have previous investigative information, we would think we were looking at a beautiful pasture, fringed by trees and behind which ran a river, and maybe you could go trout fishing in.
And so you get the information from survivors about where they think the site might be?
Well, and other investigative information, or like we saw last year, surveillance photos were released that had pictures of disturbances that people asserted were graves.
And how do you begin to disinter the bodies from the grave?
Well, first you have to ascertain really that their body's there. That's the first phase.
How do you do that?
And one way to do it would be to find the area that the grave is presumed to be in, or probe the area to detect that there's decomposing material underneath, and you could test trench it and dig right down to the surface of the bodies and actually see them. Then once we've done that, then we would try to get an idea of the size of the grave. That is the area, the area extent, not so much the depth, because we oftentimes don't know the depth until we've completely emptied the grave. And so we define the perimeter of the grave itself, and then you can put together your strategy for approaching the grave. Once we've gotten the perimeter and decide how we're actually going to approach the grave, then the idea basically is to remove the overburden, the dirt, the debris, the material that's on top of the bodies. And once you get close to the bodies, then we try to very carefully define the individuals. It's almost like bringing them forward in a relief. You remove the dirt, the bodies are the relief that's left. Then you find that, you know, one body starts here. You might start with a hand, for instance, and then you follow the hand up the arm. And then you might run into the leg of another individual that's on top of them. So then you uncover the leg of that individual, find out there's a torso of somebody on top of that. That person may be the top individual, and you can uncover that whole body. That would be your choice of the first body to take out, depending upon how much of the grave you wanted to expose at any one time. So you define the complete body, and then you remove it, because the object is to remove complete individuals, because that raises the potential of the story that the victims can tell, and also the possibility of identifying the individual and knowing most about them.
What kind of condition have most of the bodies been in Bosnia that you've disinterred?
Well, that's a good question. The bodies at the Cerska site were well on their way to becoming skeletons. The bodies that we're presently digging are very well preserved. However, in one grave, it has somewhat to do with the proximity of the body itself to the surface of the ground. It has to do with the actual environment of the grave itself. The first grave, where the bodies were skeletalized, had very good drainage, very loosely compacted, very loose soil. The the bodies were very shallowly buried, and so that when the sun shone on the hillside, it could warm up the ground and warm up the bodies under the ground, and they would accelerate their decomposition. The site now is fine clay. It holds the water very well. It provides a cool environment for the bodies, so the bodies are actually relatively stable and preserved. So it retards decomposition in the normal sense that we think of it, at least in making skeletons. Each grave actually has its own character, dependent upon many variables, like the ones we've just mentioned.
I guess the story that a body can tell you is going to be different if the body has already decomposed or if the body is more intact.
Yeah, in some respects. I mean, the more fresh the body is, the more soft tissue evidence that you have. For instance, if we speak in terms of identification, if you have soft tissue, you have a very fresh body, you can recognize features, you could see tattoos, you could get fingerprints. With skeletons, you can't do that. As time goes on, the evidence becomes more rarefied. That's true.
Now, if the body's decomposing, do the clothes help hold the body together so that you can determine which parts belong to which body?
Absolutely. The clothing provides an envelope for the body and really assists us, especially with skeletalized remains, for holding the body together. The most problematic areas, of course, are hands and feet that aren't in shoes, or areas that are really maybe fractured and traumatized. Those are areas that are difficult to pick up. So usually when we have, for instance, skeletalized remains, as many of the remains were at Cirska, then we would have to pick up all the bones of the hands separately and separately bag those and make sure that they stayed with the individual in their own separate body bag as we collected them.
Do the positions of the bodies in the grave reveal information that the War Crimes Tribunal could use?
Yes.
Is that telling?
It's telling on several levels. And I guess today I looked in this grave and I saw people in sitting postures, people sprawled on their backs. Their bodies are very jumbled in akimbo and just sprawled out and intertwined. And I was thinking as we had them sort of released so that you could sort of see them lying there. It's very, you know, and you have hands tied behind their back. You know, I've seen some of these paintings by Chagall where you have dreams. It almost looked like I would envision a Chagall nightmare, these remains lying in there in these grotesque positions and light, almost lifelike postures and then really contorted positions. It was very, very moving to see that.
What information do those positions give you?
Well, it gives you the information that they were put in that grave with disrespect. They were just thrown away, discarded, covered up. That's one of the some of the information it gives you. It can give you information about the sequence in which they were placed in the grave. It can give you could give you information about the relative time that people were killed. Sometimes graves that, for instance, contain family members from larger groups that can tell you information about who's related to who, because often that's not uncommon that family members will huddle together and hold hands as they're being killed.
Can you tell if the bodies you've been exhuming are the bodies of civilians or soldiers?
They're dressed as civilians.
And that's,
I guess I might ask you, why do you ask that question? It's been asked about 30 times to me today. Why is that an important question?
I assume it's an important question because I think, you know, that in times of war, there's a different standard that's applied to killing soldiers than to killing civilians. And so I would imagine that in a war crimes tribunal, there'd be a different standard that people were held to if they killed civilians.
Not if they have their hands bound behind their backs and are defenseless when they're executed.
Good point. So that's violating international standards.
Yes.
Whether they're soldiers or civilians.
That's correct. Yes.
On the phone from us from Bosnia-Herzegovina is Dr. William Haglund, and he's a forensic anthropologist who's leading an investigative team that is exhuming mass graves in Bosnia. The evidence they collect will be given to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and the forensics team is coordinated by the group Physicians for Human Rights. Dr. Haglund, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. William Haglund, a forensic anthropologist who's leading an investigative team that is exhuming mass graves in Bosnia. Dr. Haglund, I imagine that exhuming these graves, that you're exposed to the constant stench of death, and I wonder what you do to protect yourself against that.
Well, actually, it was funny because a reporter asked me today to give her the chemical formula for the odor of death. But yes, bodies decompose and they don't smell pleasant. You sort of get used to it. I have always felt that your nose sort of dies on you, and it's wiser than you are, and you just get accustomed to it. Some people wear masks. Our people are really not doing that at this point. The smell is something you become accustomed to.
What's the psychological toll that this work takes on you?
Well, I am asked that all the time, and I'm not really aware of the great psychological toll. A psychological morass that people might perceive that they would get in dealing with death has a lot to do with their own experiences with death and fears of death and maybe inexperiences with death. The undercurrent and what buoys that up, it's just the activities that you're doing. You believe in them, or you're engrossed. You're just subsumed by them because there are things that propel you through the whole event. I think there's also a feeling of historicity in what we're doing. I think there's a feeling of privilege. There's a feeling of challenge. There's a feeling of exhaustion at the end of the day. And I think all of that sort of adds to this psychological gestalt, but it's not a negative thing.
Well, what do you do at night? I mean, do you have a way to unwind at night? Do you feel guilty?
Well,
guilty if you have a good time at night?
No, absolutely not. We talk to each other. The first thing we do when we get home is try to find a shower with a shower cubicle with a handle on it so that you can operate the showers. Seems like the people sort of take the handles off the shower so that they make sure they have one so somebody else can't steal it. Then we go and eat. And then with fresh clothes and food, people do various things. Some people read a book. Some people are working on the computers, catching up with the spreadsheets. I've been on the phone right now for 2.5-3 hours. And after that, I'll probably go work on the computer for a bit and maybe read a book, go to sleep.
What are you reading?
Oh, I'm just reading detective novels.
Perfect.
Finished Snow Falling on Cedars and we're trading books around.
Was this work as easy for you to do? And when I say easy, I mean that you can do your work without obsessing on the deaths and without having so much empathy that it gets in the way of your work. Were you able to do that the first time you exhumed a mass grave?
Yes. I think the thing that's really obsessing to me is the details of what it takes to get this done.
Right.
Of where the next anthropologist has come from, or where are the trowels, or where's the metric graph paper, things like that. I worked in a very fine medical examiner's office in Seattle. It has a fine national reputation. I worked there for 16 years. I like my job, like the people I was working with. Things got to be, you know, the same and repetitive. I needed something different to do. This seemed much more challenging in a lot of ways, and it offered me a way to be more focused on the anthropology than just more death in general in that context of the job that I was in. And I felt that I wanted to do the human rights, and I wanted to focus on the anthropology. And mass graves are in some ways a horizon that is not really well understood in forensic anthropology and in forensic investigations. Because fortunately, we haven't had to do really mass graves, and we've been arguing the last couple of days of what is a mass grave? Is it two or more people or three or more people?
Is that important to...
The numbers? No, well, it's semantics. To me, it's not important. To me, what's important is what I would like to think is important is that these are individual human beings, and that's why you're there. And to the survivors that are wondering where their loved one is, where their husband, their father, their sister, their brother, their daughter, their spouse, whatever, they're wondering where those people are. It doesn't really matter to them if that person is dead in the grave with 5,000 people or 10 people or 20 people, or they're alone. They're dead. They're gone. They don't know where they are. They don't know where they are, and that's the tragedy in it all. The numbers get the attention of the world. The numbers compile and make more compelling the urge and the will of tribunals and that to investigate. But the personal tragedy to the survivors is there if it's one person or a mass grave, whatever you want to define a mass grave as being.
Dr. Haglund, thank you so much for taking some time out to talk with us.
Okay.
Dr. William Haglund is a forensic anthropologist leading a forensics team exhuming mass graves in Bosnia. They're reporting to the International War Crimes Tribunal. The team is sponsored by the group Physicians for Human Rights. Haglund says his team expects to unearth 4 to 6 more mass grave sites for the tribunal. After Bosnia, Haglund expects to return to Rwanda. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mario Puzo not only wrote the novel The Godfather and co-wrote the Godfather screenplays, he was the first to use the word to describe the head of a mafia family. We'll talk with Puzo about writing The Godfather and about his new novel, The Last Don. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
We've known each other many years, but this is the first time you ever came to me for counsel or for help. I can't remember the last time that you invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder for money.
I ask you for justice. How much shall I pay you?
Buonasera. Buonasera. What have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectfully? If you'd come to me in friendship, then the scum that ruined your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies. And then they would fear you.
Be my friend? Godfather?
Good. Someday, and that day may never come, I'll call upon you to do a service for me. But until that day, accept this justice as a gift on my daughter's wedding day.
Grazie, Godfather.
Later.
Okay, The Godfather might not have been the most realistic portrayal of the mafia, but it's a great film. My guest Mario Puzo wrote the novel it's based on and co-wrote all three Godfather screenplays. Now he's written his first novel in 5 years, and it takes him back to the territory he's best known for. In the new novel, The Last Don, a mafia family tries to go legit and branches out into Vegas casinos and Hollywood studios. Puzo writes so convincingly about the mafia, people always assume he has some inside connection, which he denies. I asked Mario Puzo how the mafia became the theme of so much of his work.
It started off my second novel, The Fortunate Pilgrim, where a minor character was a mafia leader. And everybody said, gee, you should have had more of that character. And really, all it is telling stories I heard in my childhood, you know, about people in the neighborhood and all that stuff.
What neighborhood was it?
Hell's Kitchen in New York.
Now, isn't that primarily an Irish neighborhood?
It was, then it became Italian. So when I was growing up, it was primarily Italian with a good mixture of Irish and who started off as enemies and then intermarried a great deal.
So who'd you hear the stories from?
Oh, members of my family, you know, like the rug-stealing scene and the keeping of the guns from the police, you know, that kind of stuff that happened in the family.
Oh, well, tell the story the way it was told to you.
Well, my brother, who's older than me, this guy threw his guns over the airway, you know, the space between apartments, and my mother took them and held them for him. And then he came and got back his guns, and he said, would you like a rug? So she sent my brother over to get the rug. And my brother didn't realize the guy was stealing the rug until he took out the gun when the cop came. So that's almost entirely in the book and in the movie, you know. And there's little stuff like that.
Now, how did your mother feel about protecting this guy's guns?
Oh, in those days, this is when I was a very little kid, that was thought of as nothing. You know, that was like he was a neighbor and he wanted you to do it. And you did it because you were afraid of him, because you hoped, you know, that he would help you out.
Do you think your mother looked at the mob figures in your neighborhood as people who could protect your family or as people who were more likely to harm your family?
No, protect. Because, for instance, the business about the dog being permitted to stay in the apartment, that happened to my family. My mother didn't want to get rid of the dog, so she went to the local guy of respect. I don't even think they thought of them as criminals. There were people who had influence, the way you would go down to your congressman, for instance.
So tell the dog story.
No, as it happened in the movie, the landlord wanted my mother to get rid of the dog, and she didn't want to get rid of the dog. He was going to kick her out, and the local whatever he was. I never really understood what he was. He told the landlord not to do it, and the landlord didn't do it.
Did she owe anything in return?
No, it was she was the cousin or the niece of somebody who knew the mafia guy. You know, one of those very family things, you know, a family courtesy.
Did she do anything to pay respect to the local organized crime figures who in part controlled the neighborhood?
Well, you have to remember that those figures are usually related by blood, you know, and were members of a family, so you gave them presents. If you had a family member who was powerful, you made sure that you gave him a present at Christmas, you know, or a special occasion, which was not regarded as a payoff in any way. It was, for instance, my parents grew up in Italy, where, since they were mostly illiterate, when they had a letter that had to be read, they would go to the local priest to have the priest read it for them, but they would automatically bring a gift. They'd bring a 3 or 4 eggs or, you know, chicken or something like that. It's a whole different relationship. It wasn't a bribe. It's a mark of respect. It's not like they said, you got to give me a piece of chicken or you got to give me an egg and I'll read it for you. It was just understood. In the same way, the local neighborhood guys that had influence, you gave them presents.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mario Puzo. He wrote The Godfather. He co-wrote the screenplays for the Godfather movies. His new novel is called The Last Don, and it's about organized crime and Hollywood and Vegas. Describe Don Corleone the way you first envisioned him.
He was sort of very much like you had a brother who was much older than you, who would always protect you, you know, who would always stick up for you. He was somebody who was a protector.
I'm wondering if the character of Don Corleone was changed in your mind when Marlon Brando was cast in the film and you saw Marlon Brando inhabit the character.
No, I'm the guy that picked Brando.
You did pick Brando?
Oh, sure. I wrote him a letter and he called me up and we had a chat, and then I tried to get Paramount to take him and they refused, and then when the director came on the picture, I talked to the director, Francis Copeland. He managed to talk Paramount into letting Brando play the role. But it was my idea to cast Brando, which caused me a lot of trouble before it finally got done.
What did you say in your letter to Marlon Brando when you were inviting him to play the part?
I think it was something like, help, they're going to kill me. They're going to cast, I think it was Danny Thomas as the guy.
Danny Thomas? Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was going to buy Paramount so he could play the role. At that time, Paramount wasn't really worth that much, and Danny Thomas was very rich off television. And I read an item, he was going to buy Paramount Pictures so he could play The Godfather. So that scared me so much, I wrote a letter to Brando. I knew some people who knew him, so, you know, I had an entree. And he gave me very good advice. He said, no studio will hire me. Wait until you get a director, and then talk to the director. And he's quite right. When I talked to the studio, they swore they would never hire Brando.
Why were they so opposed to the idea?
Well, because Brando had built up what to them was a terrible reputation of being a troublemaker, you know, on his mutiny on a bounty. We cost him a lot of money, and you know, he was always a rebel. So they didn't want him in their movies. He was too much of a headache, and his movies had been flops.
Did he cause any trouble for you on the set?
No, well, I was never on the set, but they tell me it was perfect. You know, every actor just loved the idea of working with Brando. He's their idol. So, and when he came on the picture, he caused no trouble for the director. He caused no trouble for the actors. He was, they really liked him.
What were some of the battles that you and Francis Ford Coppola had to fight with the studio?
Well, over Al Pacino. And at first I was for Al Pacino. Then when he tested so terribly, I was against him. And then Francis talked me around into being for him again, you know, because I had given Francis a letter saying I wanted Pacino. And after I saw him test, I told Francis, give me my letter back. And he says, no, wait, you wouldn't give me the letter back.
What was so bad about the test?
Francis knew what was wrong with him. He said he was very insecure. And it's sort of like his way of saying, you know, the hell with you guys. I don't have to test for you guys. I think. Because Pacino, who I got to know a little bit, is really like the most dedicated actor, the most dedicated work person that I've ever met in the movies.
Now, what were some of the most difficult parts of adapting the novel into the screenplay?
You mean the first one?
Yeah, the
first
novel one? Of The Godfather.
It was a cinch.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it was a cinch because it was the first time I'd ever written a screenplay, so I didn't know what I was doing, you know, and it came out right. And the story I tell is that after I had won 2 Academy Awards, you know, for the first 2 Godfathers, I went out and bought a book on screenwriting because I figured I'd better learn, you know, what it's about, because it was sort of off the top of my head. And then the first chapter of the book said, study Godfather 1 as the model of a screenplay. So I was stuck with the book.
Now, I'm wondering, with the dialogue, everything is so, I mean, not everything, but the characters who really have power are very euphemistic in their language. So they could be saying, they could be giving you the message that they're going to kill you unless you follow their orders, but they'll be saying it in the nicest way. And of course, killing would never be mentioned. Everything's kind of beneath, you know, between the lines, beneath the surface. What made you write the dialogue for these powerful, violent people in that coded way?
Well, it does come from the way the Sicilian mafia operated. In fact, there was a funny story that an Englishman came to live in Sicily, and he got a kidnapping note, because they like to collect the money for kidnapping you before they kidnap you, so they didn't have to go to the bother of kidnapping you. That was the way they operated. But the Sicilian mafia wrote this Englishman such a flowery note that he really didn't understand what they were saying. He had to get an interpreter in. He thought they were paying him some sort of compliment. He didn't realize they wanted like 50 grand off him before they kidnapped him, so to save everybody the trouble of going through the kidnapping. But it was very flowery. Your Eminence, we love you, you know, we'll do anything. If you have any trouble, give us a call, you know. And meanwhile, just send us 50 grand and you'll never have any trouble with anybody. But that's how they talk. That's where I got it from, you know. That and that horse's head thing was strictly from Sicilian folklore. They nailed the head of your favorite dog to your door as the first warning if you didn't pay the money. They were great believers in collecting money before doing the job.
One of the most famous lines that you came up with was about making an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah.
Does that line have its roots in mob lore that you knew, or did
I made it up. I wrote memos on how we could plant that line because I was sure it would become a famous line. You know, I recognized the fact it would become one of those lines that people would always be using. So that was really sort of carefully constructed, you know.
My guest is Mario Puzo, author of The Godfather and co-author of all 3 Godfather screenplays. His new novel is called The Don. Here's another scene from The Godfather.
Well, when Johnny was first starting out, he was signed to this personal service contract from the big band leader. And as his career got better and better, he wanted to get out of it. Now, Johnny is my father's godson, and my father went to see this band leader. And he offered him $10,000 to let Johnny go. But the band leader said no. So the next day, my father went to see him, only this time with Luca Brasi. And within an hour, he signed a release for a certified check of $1,000.
How'd he do that?
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What was that?
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract. That's a true story.
We'll talk more with Mario Puzo after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mario Puzo. He has a new novel called The Last Don. Did you come up with the expression Godfather?
Yeah. And that was really an accident. Because before I used that, no mafia man ever used the word Godfather in that sense. Nobody used it. And I got it from an Italian family culture. The friend of your parents, when you're a little kid, your parents have very close friends, you call them godfather and godmother the way in the American culture you call family friends aunt and uncle, even though they're not your aunt and uncle. You know, if they're a close family friend, you know, and you're a kid, you say that's auntie or uncle so-and-so. So that was just the only way in which it was used, except this, in the religious sense. So I remembered it, and the more I used it during the book, the more it became, you know, what it was.
Do you think
so? So now the mafia uses it. Everybody uses it, you know, and the word didn't exist.
Now, a lot of the Godfather stories and a lot of The Last Don are set in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And you've been known to gamble.
I spent a lot of time in Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Now, in different eras that you were in Vegas, did you have a different sense of how much mob control there was there?
Yeah, when I first went out there, I had the sense that the mob controlled the town completely. And then as time went on, it became less and less, you know, because those mob guys were retiring and with their fortunes and leaving, you know, leading a nice bourgeois life.
And did you like Vegas more or less after the mob left?
I loved it when the mob ran it. I don't like it when the big business is running it.
Why did you prefer it when the mob was running it?
Well, because the mob operated on its own myth. And all they wanted all your money, but they want you to like them anyway. You know, like, so they gave you a lot of things in return for taking all your money. With the bottom line people in Vegas now today, it's different. It's not glamorous anymore. And the difference is this, when the mob ran gambling in Vegas, gambling was not a collective, you couldn't collect it legally. Now today, with all the gambling casinos you have, gambling debts are now legally collectible. So you were better off under the mob, you know, where they couldn't collect the debts legally. And they wouldn't, all the strong-arm stuff, as far as I could find out, you would never harm a gambler, no matter how much money he owed you, because it's like abusing an automobile. You know, this is a guy that's going to earn your money in the future, so you try and treat him right.
Was it dangerous for you to make a lot of money and then go to Vegas? Did you risk gambling away a lot of the money that you earned?
No, no. I was never a degenerate gambler. In other words, I was not a gambler that gambled to such an extent that it affected his style of living.
Your novel and the Godfather movies have had such an impact on American popular culture. And I'm wondering what you think it is about the stories that enabled them to have the impact that they had.
Well, I think it's a story with warm personal family feeling. And I think also it's everybody's wish, I mean, that they would have somebody they could go to who would correct all their injustices without the problems of going to court, hiring a lawyer, you know, somebody fixing up your world for you.
And if you cross them, you'd be dead.
But that's okay, because why would you want to cross them if they, you know, did everything for you?
Of course, everybody does end up crossing. I mean, everybody ends. There's always a bloodbath.
People are not perfect.
Yeah. My guest is Mario Puzo, author of The Godfather and co-author of all three Godfather screenplays. His new novel is called The Last Don. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Mario Puzo is my guest, and he has a new novel called The Last Don. Now, how did you become a reader and a writer? You've said that your parents were nearly illiterate.
They were illiterate, yeah. And because of the public libraries and the Settlement House Library, Hudson Gill Settlement House Library, and you started to read, and it was just the greatest thing in the world to read, that's all.
What did your parents think of you reading? It was something that they couldn't do. Were they proud of you for being able to do it?
No. I wrote a line someplace where my mother regarded my library card with the same horror that present-day mothers look at their son's heroin needles. You know, I made some sort of comparison to that. Reading was not relevant. Reading didn't help you make a living, you know?
Wrong.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So what did they think you should be doing? What did your mother think you should be doing instead?
Oh, you know, good clerical job on the inside. If you could avoid hard labor, that was the big thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what your mother was thinking, that you couldn't make money as a writer, I think that was true of your first couple of books.
It was very true, yeah.
Did you figure that would always be the case, that you were never really going to make money writing?
I always thought I would become rich and famous and be a great writer. I always believed that until, let's see, when I stopped believing that. I stopped believing that after I wrote The Godfather. I'm only kidding. I think you get less confident as you become more successful. Before I was successful, I was very arrogant as a writer. You know, I wouldn't listen to anybody.
And after you became successful, you lost faith?
I was very shaky.
What could you explain that phenomenon?
Oh, I think it's easy to be arrogant when you're unsuccessful because you have nothing to lose. And, you know, I know I used to brag a lot more when I was unsuccessful than I do now. I do my share of bragging now, but before I was successful, I was really terrible.
How have you reacted to criticisms from Italians, for instance, that in American popular culture, Italians are always shown as mob figures, and criticisms from people who say that the Godfather movies were just really violent and, you know, up the amount of violence in American popular culture?
Yeah, well, it sounds like some of my relatives, but but to me, it's a completely irrelevant thing. For one thing, there was a time when Italians ran crime in America, so I'm not maligning them in any way. In fact, I present them as very lovable people, you know, that have to make a living, unfortunately, in a way that society doesn't approve. But also, I know that most Italians that I grew up with were so law-abiding, they, you know, that getting a traffic ticket was terrible, you know? You know, it's for the working-class Italian people.
Have you always operated very strictly inside the law?
Myself?
Yeah.
Very much so, except in one incident. Because, well, let me see if I can phrase it properly. I would have become a criminal if I had the nerve, but since I didn't have the nerve to be a criminal, I decided to become a writer.
You think you would have become a criminal if you had the nerve?
Sometimes when I'm dealing with movie studios.
Does it bring out your most violent impulses?
Well, yeah, you know, there's sometimes when you want to... You only wish that you could go to a Godfather and say, you know, get these guys out of my shoe, you know?
Well, why? What's an example of something that has made you really angry, made you feel really crossed, that a film studio has done?
Well, not on artistic grounds, by the way. I had an unfortunate couple of experiences where I wrote screenplays that were very successful. Not Paramount, by the way. I'm not talking about the Godfather movies, other movies. Where I had to sue to get my money, my percentage of the movie turned out to be very profitable, and I collect the percentage on the back end, and I have to sue to get my back end. And at that time, I was so innocent, I thought that was so outrageous that here I had given them a piece of work that earned them a great deal of money. Why wouldn't they want to give me my share, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd put up legal blocks that you have to fight, and then they surrender in the end, but after they cost you a great deal of money, you know. And also, it's insulting, you know, that you feel you've done a good bit of work, you've earned the money, and then they don't want to pay you. You know, it's so ungrateful. You feel, when you're innocent like that, it's so ungrateful of them. And after a while, you get used to it.
Well, Mario Puzo, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mario Puzo has a new novel called The Last Don. He wrote the novel The Godfather and co-wrote all three Godfather screenplays.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Louisa Shafia. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember writer Jessica Mitford with a 1989 interview. She died Tuesday of cancer at the age of 78. Also, an interview with Isabel Allende. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.